purging the Islamic opposition. In June 1981, when the war with Iraq was at a critical stage, the Iranian forces were demoralized and popular enthusiasm for the regime was dwindling, the Majlis moved to impeach Banisadr on charges of incompetence, ill intentions, and defiance toward the Guardian jurist, all charges carrying a subtext of treason. In an orchestrated move, Khomeini duly dismissed his first president only 15 months after blessing his election to the office. Shortly before his dismissal, Banisadr had already been removed by Khomeini's order from the post of commander-in-chief of the armed forces, a position the imam had bestowed on him at the beginning of the war. Weeks earlier, the Khomeinist press and media sharpened their attacks on the president and his supporters, accusing him of compromise and deviating from the revolutionary path. But more was in the offing. Fearing the perils ahead, Banisadr had already gone into hiding in Tehran in the house of Massoud Rajavi, 1948 to approximately 2016, a leader of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. A change in climate in favour of the Khomeinists was clearly palpable. The radicals had gathered enough acumen in a short space of time not to leave the job of governing to the outsiders, nor were they willing to tolerate compromising liberals lecturing on the splendours of democracy or the deviating People's Mujahideen selling their classless society. Soon after Banisadr's downfall, a new presidential election brought Rajai to office with a margin that claimed to be even larger than Banisadr's. Khomeini, too, astutely recognised that hardliner loyalty was far more vital to him than sustaining a doomed presidency. 43 days after his disappearance, in a dramatic escape, Banisadr resurfaced in Paris, along with Massoud Rajavi, who had survived the anti-Mujahideen purges. They flew in disguise aboard an Air Force 707, flown by a colonel who formerly served as the Shah's personal pilot. Banisadr's disguise cost him his famous moustaches, though in Paris he soon returned to his former self, minus, of course, the cachet as the Islamic Republic's first president. His reliance on the Mujahideen, though largely tactical, came at an expense not only to him, but also to the Mujahideen's rank and file. The collapse of Banisadr triggered a reign of terror that soon engulfed all non-affiliated revolutionary and non-revolutionary political organizations that the Islamic regime viewed as real or imagined competition. Besides the Mujahideen, who were the crackdown's main target and most numerous victims, the purge extended to the Marxist Fadayan and the Maoist Paykar. Even moderates such as the National Front and Freedom Movement were not spared. By February 1983, 4 years into the Islamic Republic, the raging flames even caught up with the Tudeh party, which, despite its consistent pandering at Khomeini's gate and praising the progressive virtues of the Islamic Revolution, was soon subject to arrest and eventual elimination. The 10-month-long coup de grace of 1981 to 1982 can thus justifiably be seen as the third stage of the revolution. While February 1979 brought down the Pahlavi Ancien Régime and the hostage crisis wiped out the step-by-step Bazargan model, the fall of Banisadr and the purging of the opposition, coinciding with mass mobilization for the war with Iraq, brought the greatest concentration of power into the hands of the hardliner Khomeinists. At the core of the anti-Banisadr camp was Mohammad Beheshti, chief of the judiciary and the most influential leader of the Islamic Republican Party. Behind him was Rafsanjani, then the Speaker of the Majlis and an up-and-coming enabler of clerical supremacy. Others outside the party, such as Khalkhali, the head of the revolutionary courts, were no less hostile, and Khomeini himself required little persuasion. Banisadr's tacit pact with the Mujahideen-e-Khalq was sufficiently vilifying. From the early days of the Islamic Republic, Khomeini and his disciples had looked upon the Mujahideen with a mix of suspicion, fear, and resentment. Mujahideen's flirting in the early months of the revolution with Father Taleghani, as they referred to their presumed patron, did not help remedy doctrinal differences with the Khomeinists or conceal mutual enmities between them. The Mujahideen's widespread recruitment of young men and women, mostly high school and university students, their well-organized and disciplined cadres, and their program of ideological indoctrination turned them into a formidable force ahead of all other brands of opposition. Mujahideen's amalgam of idealized but selective Islamic teachings, romantic readings of early Shi'i history drenched in martyr worship via Ali Shariati, and a watered-down Marxist-Leninist theory of class struggle with a veneer of a socialist political economy, was appealing. Despite being cultish and hierarchical, to the point of resembling a fascist party, the Mujahideen's appeal to young women and men lay in their seemingly liberating message, which contrasted starkly with the male-dominated, paternalistic Islam of the Khomeinists. In reality, the Mujahideen had become an Islamicized answer to the demands of a younger generation for agency. Breaking gender barriers and allowing a greater mix of the sexes under an Islamic canopy and a collectivized morality code was the key. While it required headscarves for women and button-down shirts for men, it allowed for a brotherly, sisterly interaction and instilled a strong spirit of sacrifice, armed struggle, and hero worship. It provided a ready-made package of doctrinaire answers to complex questions posed by the revolution. Even before Banisadr's flight, the pro-regime militias, soon to be labelled Hezbollahis, from the Quranic Hezbollah, or Party of God, armed with sticks and clubs, interrupted opposition rallies, especially of the Mujahideen. In a matter of weeks, such clashes turned into bloody street battles between the Revolutionary Guards and the armed cadres of the Mujahideen, resulting in hundreds dead and thousands, perhaps as many as 5,000, arrested. The Mujahideen supporters were mostly from urban, lower-middle classes with religious backgrounds. Fired with revolutionary zeal and too anxious to resort to armed struggle, they carried the legacy of the older generation of the Mujahideen leadership. In Pahlavi prisons, they honed their dialectical rationale that made them adamant, as they frequently claimed, that they are the only alternative to the reactionary Khomeinists. Under Rajavi and his cohort Musa Khiabani, 1943-1982, the People's Mujahideen grew to be a formidable paramilitary force with a wide network, safe houses, a cache of weapons looted from the army barracks in February 1979, and a steadfast cadre of young men and women with some experience in urban warfare. Resorting to an armed insurgency thus seemed to them inevitable when they effectively were pushed out of the political process along with all other forces of opposition, a deadly miscalculation for which they paid dearly. In clashes that lasted through early 1982, small Mujahideen cells operating in the capital and provincial cities lost most of their recruits in street battles. Frequently, clashes occurred when a Mujahideen safe house was identified, leaving them no choice but to defend themselves. The alternative was torture and often death in detention. Daring and brave, they nevertheless were outgunned and outmaneuvered by the Revolutionary Guards. In a déjà vu reminiscent of the Pahlavi era, the Mujahideen proved utterly wrong in assuming that the bold act of resistance would miraculously prompt a public uprising against the regime. Armed clashes came with a barrage of anti-Mujahideen propaganda from the Islamic Republic. Their label as eclectics, el-Tegati, in the early days of the revolution, for their Islamo-Marxist doctrine, soon was degraded to hypocrites, munafiqin, a Quranic reference denoting those who accepted Islam outwardly, but inwardly retained their pagan beliefs. When confrontations turned to armed clashes, the Mujahideen were declared outright infidels, kafir, which allowed the Islamic regime to deal with them on the harshest of terms. Hundreds of Mujahideen, along with Fadayan and Pekar and their sympathizers, were summarily tried and sent before firing squads or hanged inside the Evin prison and other detention centers. Those who were spared did not find life in prison any easier. Under the gaze of a notorious revolutionary judge, Mohammad Mahamadi Gilani, 1928-2014, and chief prosecutor and prison warden Asadullah Lajivardi, 1935-1998, known as the Butcher of Evin, the inmates, men and women, were systematically tortured and humiliated, placed in long-term solitary confinement, and forced to confess their mistakes in front of television cameras. Women were forced to seek penance by sitting on their knees for hours on end in pigeonhole petitions and in total silence. Everyone had to repent and be subjected to re-education, or face more torture or possible execution. Recanting their earlier political affiliations under pressure, whether Mujahideen, Fadayan, or others on the left, they were labelled as Tawabin, repentance, a term historically denoting those who, after the Battle of Karbala in 680, renounced their allegiance to the House of Umayyads. Not unlike the style of the Khmer Rouge, the inmates at Evin University were subject to a program of Islamic rehabilitation, which in reality amounted to full indoctrination, open displays of loyalty to the Imam and the Islamic regime, and complete collaboration by disclosing the identities of their comrades and locations of safe houses. Even then, some remained suspect, were accused of insincerity, and in due course were retried and executed. Outmaneuvering Khalkhali, the revolutionary judge Gilani gained notoriety not only for his cold-blooded verdicts that sent hundreds, if not thousands, to the gallows, but for his television program in which he articulated intricate points of Shi'i jurisprudence, often with sexual undertones pertaining to temporary marriage, incest, and sodomy. His dispassionate legalistic tone, seeming at times even leisurely, stood in surreal contrast to his death verdicts, which by 1988 had acquired the definition of mass murder. His aloof clinical approach in blending ruthlessness on the judicial bench with an almost comical television performance spoke volumes of a humanistic disconnect that was the prevailing character of Gom legalism. In September 1981, in an interview with the Daily Kaihan, he declared, "Those who are arrested during street armed clashes can be lined up against the wall and shot on the spot. The wounded can also be finished off on the spot. From a religious point of view, there is no need to bring such people to court, because they have waged war on God." By October, he felt the need to further clarify his legal reasoning when, in an interview with the Daily Etelaat, he pointed out, "According to Islam, even if they, that is, Mujahideen, die under torture, no one is held accountable. This is the precise decree of the Imam." Two of Mahamadi Gilani's sons, who earlier had joined the People's Mujahideen, were among the victims of the regime. Escaping the country, close to the Turkish border, they were caught by the Revolutionary Guards. Anticipating the outcome of their arrest, they committed suicide with cyanide capsules. Their father confirmed that if they were brought before his court, they would have received the death sentence. Others among the Khomeinists did not display as much zeal as Gilani, though they were not far behind in their line of reasoning. Serving as Sharia judges, prosecutors, prison wardens, and, among the higher ranks, as head of the judiciary, ministers of information and justice, leaders of Friday prayers appointed by Khomeini and his representatives in the Revolutionary Guards, armed forces, and other sensitive organs of the government, they abided by the same guidelines. Thousands were purged, imprisoned, and executed once any affiliation with the mostly imagined forces of opposition was detected. Many sympathizers of the left were arrested on such minor charges as befriending an activist, possessing a revolutionary tract, or attending informal gatherings suspected of leftist tendencies. By mid-1982, the tail end of the Mujahideen insurgency, the regime's draconian measures had successfully created an environment of terror detrimental to any show of sympathy toward any popular cause, let alone those initiated by the left. The Mujahideen and their associates did not remain entirely passive to the regime's design to destroy them. On June 28, 1981, a week after Bani Sadr's downfall and the start of serious street clashes, a massive explosion in the headquarters of the Islamic Republican Party killed more than 70, including the Secretary-General of the party, Mohammad Beheshti. The loss of government ministers, officials, and party activists inflicted the gravest blow to the regime's leadership since the start of the revolution. The 7th of the month of Tir 1360 thus became a new red dot on the martyrdom calendar. In particular, the loss of Beheshti, eulogized as the tulip of the paradise, La Leye Behesht, deprived the clerical hierarchy of one of its most astute operators. Despite his pivotal role in establishing the Islamic Republican Party and the ousting of Bani Sadr, Beheshti was distinct from a host of Khomeinists in appreciating the complexity of the political process. More than 2 months later, in the last days of August 1981, another massive bomb went off in the office of the president, killing Muhammad Ali Rajai, 2 weeks after he had been elected president. He was killed along with his newly appointed prime minister, Muhammad Javad Bahonar, 1933-1981, a founding member of the Islamic Republican Party and the first cleric to hold an important ministerial post. The two bombings, coming at short intervals, were shocking displays of the regime's faulty security and infiltration by foes. A series of assassinations and attempted assassinations against pro-regime elements aggravated fears. Among them, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, future president and supreme leader, was the target of a bomb blast in June 1981 while preaching in a Tehran mosque. The bombings, carried out presumably by Mujahideen agents, had an enormous adverse effect on the political climate, for they tilted public sympathies toward the Khomeinists. It also alerted the regime to the lethal threat to its very survival. In return, it unleashed the harshest clampdown so far on the opposition, crushing the secular dissent. Crushing the Mujahideen served as a pretext to eradicate all other forms of dissent. Earlier on, after months of insinuations, in a fiery speech in June 1981, Khomeini had denounced the National Front leadership as apostates, primarily for calling a rally to protest the passage by the Majlis of the Law of Islamic Retribution, Qisas, the law that replaced the penal code of the Pahlavi era, inculcated such ancient punishments as stoning married women for extramarital affairs, cutting off limbs for theft and other serious offences, and determining life or death of murderers and other culprits by the mere consent of relatives of the victim, whom the new law defined as custodians of the victim's blood, Oliyaye Dam. On a broader scheme, the National Front was being punished for holding Khomeini accountable for the climate of intimidation and terror. By the summer of 1982, most leaders of the National Front either had fled the country into permanent exile or had ended up in the prisons of the Islamic Republic. Not entirely devoid of potential middle-class support, the National Front, nevertheless, found itself in no position to withstand Khomeini's rage or the terror of the club-wielding Hezbollah and their paymaster in the Islamic Republican Party. The freedom movement had been saved only barely by renouncing its old comrades in the National Front. This was a humiliating fate for a movement that had stood for national sovereignty and political freedom for three decades. Khomeini and his turbaned clique never really trusted or cared for the tie-wearing liberal nationalists. Nor did Khomeini ever acknowledge Mossadegh as a national leader or subscribe to his path. It was largely the misplaced hopes of the liberal nationalists in the early days of the revolution that made them believe Khomeini was their partner in democracy, an error they quickly began to regret. As Karim Sanjabi, the leader of the National Front, once said, "Now it is the mullahs' sleepers who've replaced military boots." Fearing for his life, in July 1981, Sanjabi went into hiding before leaving for Paris and soon after retiring in the United States. Likewise, the National Democratic Front, a competing political coalition loyal to Mossadegh's memory, was labelled heretical. Established in March 1979 by intellectuals and activists unexcited by the National Front's old-style liberalism, they advocated a secular socialist outlook. After the daily Ayan Degan, affiliated with the Democratic Front, was closed on August 8, 1979, most leaders were harassed and driven into exile. In Paris, the Democratic Front's leadership collaborated with the Mujahideen and other oppositional elements associated with Bani Sadr to create the National Council of Resistance. For a short while, the council was a promising voice of opposition abroad, though in practice it proved a liability for secular intellectuals unaccustomed to the Mujahideen's authoritarian outlook and paramilitary conduct. Once the latter's collaboration with the Iraqi Ba'athist regime became too embarrassing for any self-respecting Iranian nationalist, the council virtually dissolved. The last of the political parties to go was the Tudeh party. Despite the devious pretensions of its leadership, insisting that they were loyal to the People's Revolution, declaring that socialist principles are in harmony with revolutionary Islam, and saluting Khomeini as an anti-imperialist champion, they scarcely overcame Khomeini's innate mistrust of the left. Nor did it remain immune to the regime's wrath, despite careful treading down a tactical path or collaborating with the regime on issues of intelligence and security. From the early days of the revolution, the Tudeh recruited from among the old comrades, but also the ideologically inclined younger generations. It also embraced a merger with the so-called majority, Aksariyat, faction of the Fadayan-e-Khalq. Not the least remorseful of its past history, the Tudeh leadership steadfastly followed a pro-Soviet party line. Entertaining high hopes for their future, it infiltrated the middle ranks of the regime's nascent security and intelligence apparatus, evidently counting on long-term gains once the inept mullahs handed them the reins of power in desperation. Major figures such as Ehsan Tabari, 1917-1989, a respected theoretician of the party and a historian of some weight, Nur ad-Din Kianouri, 1915-1999, the party's general secretary, notorious for his checkered record before 1953, and Mariam Firouz, 1913-2008, the most prominent woman among the Tudeh ranks, were survivors of the party's cadre who escaped to the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in the late 1940s and early 1950s. They returned to Iran after decades of exile, bringing experience and discipline, but also a doctrinaire brand of Marxism that tried hard to comply with the rhetoric of the radical clergy and their spirit of militancy. Like many on the left, including liberal intellectuals, the Tudeh naively assumed that the days of the mullahs were numbered. Like many progressives, the Tudeh, too, relished the historical necessity of revolutionary action against the degenerate Pahlavi monarchy, and often sneered at such bourgeois values as human and civil rights, unless they were in their favour. If not in words, at least in deeds, nearly all means were legitimate if they were serving their end and fulfilling their lofty dream of the masses one day casting off the threadbare cloak of religious superstitions. The Tudeh woke up to a nightmare, however, when the Islamic regime began a massive crackdown that lasted until 1984. Despite the Tudeh's unreserved support for the Islamic Revolution in its publications and rallies, the regime's deep suspicion of the party and its activities never truly abated. Revelations of the KGB spymaster, Vladimir Kuzichkin, a one-time Soviet station chief in Tehran who defected to Britain in 1982, confirmed these fears. In his interviews with CIA officers, Kuzichkin not only revealed the identities of almost the entire Tudeh leadership, but also their infiltrators and the party's close ties to the KGB. In early 1983, the CIA secretly shared these details with the Iranian intelligence, an early gift from the agency's chief, William Casey, in the hopes that by courting Iran, the United States would be able to check presumed Soviet influence. This was at a time when the Reagan administration was about to adopt a policy of counterbalancing its massive assistance to Iraq in its war with Iran, offering incidental intelligence to Iran and consignments of weaponry constituted a series of covert measures that eventually culminated in 1985 in the Iran-Contra affair. Widespread arrests of Tudeh members by the hundreds in Tehran and the provinces were followed by their torture, long prison sentences, and executions. Soon after, in 1985, a series of panel interviews, a euphemism for forced television confessions, brought Tudeh party leaders before the cameras, where they expressed remorse for a life of communist deceit and subservience to foreign powers. They praised the Imam for his true revolutionary qualities and bowed down in servility to Islam and the revolution as the true path to salvation. Intimidation, torture, and Soviet-inspired interrogation techniques cast long and ominous shadows over these interviews. Also notable were the aftershocks of a crumbling ideological worldview. Thereafter came the memoirs and more interviews by well-known Tudeh leaders, including Tabari and Kianouri, in which the aged leaders, then in their 70s, again praised Khomeini and confessed to a life of political errors. The authenticity of these publications was deeply suspect, no doubt choreographed under duress and threat of further torture. Some of the heinous interrogators were themselves former Tudeh members and sympathizers. Now in the service of the regime's Ministry of Information, a reincarnation of Savak, they were responsible for the post-torture interrogation, when victims were broken and ready to say or write whatever pleased their captors. Of all the reversals that the Iranian people witnessed following the revolution, the confessions of the Tudeh leadership probably were the most sobering. Coinciding with massive crackdowns on Bani Sadr and Mujahideen, in April 1982, the security forces arrested Sadegh Ghozadeh, once a senior member of Khomeini's camp and at one time his Minister of Foreign Affairs. He was detained, brought to trial, and forced to make a television confession. Like Bani Sadr, he was instrumental to Khomeini's rise to prominence and, like him, was to become another devoured offspring of the revolution. He was accused of plotting a coup to assassinate Ayatollah Khomeini and topple his clerical regime. After an unusually long trial of 26 days, and after securing Khomeini's consent, on September 15, 1982, a military revolutionary tribunal convicted him of the highest treason and sent him to the gallows. Ghozadeh reportedly confessed to a plot that implicated culprits inside and outside Iran, ranging from the CIA and the Bakhtiar opposition in Paris to royalists in exile, the Socialist International, military officers, and clerical and lay figures associated with Ayatollah Shariat Madari and the Muslim People's Republican Party. If the KGB officer Kuzichkin is to be believed, Ghozadeh's removal was in part aided by the KGB, who presumably loathed him for his anti-Soviet and anti-Tudeh sentiments. According to this version, KGB agents planted in Ghozadeh's house a forged secret message from the CIA that implicated him in a largely spurious anti-regime plot. Whatever the reality, Ghozadeh was a victim of his refusal to be resigned to his political fate. A maverick with a trait of eccentricity, like many revolutionaries of his persuasion, he was rudely awakened to the fact that he had been overrun by a circle of clerical insiders who were cohesive, single-minded, and ruthless. In February 1979, as the head of Iran's broadcasting services, when he expressed disgust with clerical reactionary measures, using the popular pejorative expression Akhundbazi, that is, Mullah's conduct, he probably never imagined the grim implications of the expression. The Muslim People's Republican Party, a once powerful rival to the ruling Islamic Republican Party, was another victim. Its moderate program of reform, with elements of socialist economics, appealed to the middle classes wary of the speedy rise of the Khomeinists. Backed by Ayatollah Mohammad Kazem Shariat Madari, a moderate marja from Iranian Azerbaijan, and one time the most respected authority in Qom, the party hoped to create a wider constituency despite open hostility of the hardliners. When large rallies organized in Tabriz and other cities of Azerbaijan sufficiently worried the regime, a club-wielding mob was readily assigned to sabotage rallies and trigger violence. In the meantime, the leadership was called a stooge of the Americans, and the party was duly crushed to oblivion. Soon after Ghozadeh's execution, and in the context of the alleged plot, Khomeini ordered Shariat Madari to be defrocked, khalleh lebas, and kept under house arrest for the rest of his life. A highly unusual measure, even for Khomeini, to mistreat a fellow Ayatollah, particularly a man who once in 1962 mediated on his behalf with the Shah and probably saved Khomeini from death. It reflected the gravity of the situation in which the regime found itself. The Center for Islamic Publication and Teaching, one of the oldest in Qom, created under Shariat Madari's watch, was closed down, along with its journal Maktab-e-Islam, long a voice of Islamic non-revolutionary persuasion. Members of Shariat Madari's family were arrested and tortured. Accused of collaboration with plotters, the aging Shariat Madari, then a dignified figure of 77, was beaten and manhandled by the Minister of Information and chief henchman of the Islamic Republic, Mohammad Reshahri, born 1946. To complete his public humiliation, he too was brought before television cameras to read a statement apologizing for his misdeeds. The defrocking of a recognized marja, clearly an invented reprimand inspired by the Vatican, was an unprecedented intrusion into the recognized safe space of a high-ranking mujtahid. It was meant to exhibit Khomeini's hierarchical superiority over other marjas, especially if they didn't bow publicly to his status as imam and the guardian jurist. This was the first time in the history of clerical Shi'ism that an institutional hierarchy was set with punitive repercussions for violating it. Other marjas duly followed the lead. Save for Ayatollah Hossein Ali Montazeri, a chief lieutenant and designated successor to Khomeini, who in 1989 was to face a fate comparable to Shariat Madari, few audible objections came from Gom or other major Shi'i centres. Another casualty of the purge, though less severe, was the Hojatiyeh Society, also known as Anjumane Zede Bahaiyat, or the Anti-Baha'i Society, founded in 1953 in the aftermath of the coup. Sheikh Mahmoud Halabi, 1900-1998, a madrasa cohort of Khomeini, who established the society and became its leader, viewed anti-Baha'i activities, including harassment of individual members of that faith and disrupting their gatherings, as a duty of committed Muslims in anticipation of the coming of the hidden imam, or the proof, Hojat, hence Hojatiyeh, meaning party of the proof of God, that is, the Mahdi. The society's latent messianism was a response to the Baha'i's post-Islamic belief. On the eve of the revolution, and continuing through the post-revolutionary days, the Hojatiyeh had emerged as a cohesive non-clerical network, advocating a messianic interpretation of the Islamic revolution as a preparatory stage for the advent of the Imam of the Age. Until Mahdi's revolution, declared a favourite slogan of the Hojatiyeh, the movement continues, implying that the Islamic revolution was a prelude to the advent of the Imam of the Age. In response, those supportive of Imam Khomeini cried out, "Khomeini, Khomeini, you are a manifestation of the Imam of the Age," a clear emphasis on the authority of the guardian jurist as deputy of the hidden imam. For a while, Hojatiyeh was tolerated by its opponent, but eventually in a 1983 speech, Khomeini banned the society's activities, fearing its rising influence among the new elite. A vast number of the committed in the Islamic Republic's cadre were former Hojatiyeh and silently remained even after Khomeini's ban, loyal to its memory and its objectives. An Islamic Cultural Revolution. Removing the remnants of the Pahlavi past, and more urgently, obliterating the regime's ideological nemesis on the left and even within the Islamic fold, called not only for a takeover of political power, but also for closure of newspapers and publications run by the secular opposition. Independent newspapers such as the left-leaning Ayan Degan, which had mustered an impressive following and rendered higher standards of reporting and editorship, were the first to go. The closure of Ayan Degan, which had been in print since 1967 and had covered the pre-revolutionary and revolutionary course of events from the vantage point of the intellectuals of the left, was an ominous reminder to a generation of activists of the liberal left who embraced the revolution as a paragon of an open society and freedom of press. The confiscation of the paper's offices by the order of the Attorney General of the Islamic Republic, and after the passage of a highly restrictive press law in August 1979, made it clear that the Islamic authorities had no stamina for even tamed criticism of the regime's excesses. Ayan Degan was the first among other newspapers and journals that either brought into silence in the following months and years or completely taken over by supporters of Khomeini. If the stringent monitoring of the Ministry of Islamic Guidance was not sufficient to intimidate journalists and force them to silence, the Hezbollah vigilantes and the Comités shock troops were. The two major national dailies were simply taken over at the outset of the revolution and nationalized. After a thorough purge of the staff, control of these papers was entrusted to Khomeini's aides or to the most egregious hardliners. the official organ of the Islamic Republican Party, and other well-funded government journals and newspapers, also had their share in the Islamification of the press. By 1983, the forced closure of almost all independent newspapers and journals left a faint shadow of the burgeoning press, which had exceeded 100 periodicals in 1980. Along with the press, educational and cultural institutions were obvious targets of a regime with a pronounced cultural agenda, purging all uncommitted faculty, staff, and students from institutes of higher education, and Islamization of education at all levels soon became a major preoccupation of the Islamic Republic. At the core of what came to be known as the Cultural Revolution, Engelab-e Farangi, stood a deep resentment of the secular educational system that had emerged since the turn of the 20th century. Such a vindictive attitude may be attributed to the past belittling, even denial, of the brand of knowledge often viewed by the Pahlavi rule as arcane and backward, in contradistinction to what was revered in the Shi'i teaching circles of Qom and Najaf. Though in most respects, the radical clergy camp and their lay associates viewed modern technical, scientific, and medical education as realities congruent with Islamic teaching, they felt that traditional brands of Islamic knowledge, especially jurisprudence, were unjustly ignored and even ridiculed. More so, especially since the 1960s, they felt that the university environment was tainted with moral laxity and Western depravity, including various flavors of Marxist ideology, and that the Pahlavi cultural elite for long nursed a deep grudge against anything associated with traditional Shi'i education. This is what the Islamic authorities and its civil agents aimed to transform. The discourse of West toxication, Garb Zadegi, a legacy of Ulle Ahmad, also had its place. And so did Shariati's idealized radical Islamism. Both contributed to an air of moral indignation adopted by Ayatollah Khomeini and his commissars of the Cultural Revolution, who frequently characterized universities as dens of disbelief, where students are conditioned to disdain Islam and its teachings. Class disparity also played a part, purging the venerable faculty with obvious grudge, often by revolutionary agents of lower social standing, symbolized a victory over the old educational elite. The extent of the purge, and its centrality to the regime's ethos, is also evident in what can be described only as the conquest of Tehran University. As in other universities and institutes of higher education, Tehran University in the early days of the revolution had turned into a bastion of the Fadayan and Mujahideen organization and recruitments, another motive for the forces of the Hezbollah to take over campuses all over the country and purge undesired elements from among students and faculty. Immediately after the victory of the revolution, every week thousands of supporters of the regime occupied the Tehran University's soccer field at the center of the campus to set Friday congregational prayers. The symbolic gesture, complete with the leader of the prayer delivering hellfire sermons, Khatbeh, with a G3 rifle in hand, denouncing domestic and foreign enemies of Islam, was meant to underscore the regime's Islamic sovereignty in a venerable center of educational modernity. As if a ritual, the audience responded with salutes to the Prophet and his progeny, followed by death to America, death to idol worshippers, death to hypocrites, and death to other flavors of the week. That Friday prayer was to be held on the campus of an institution that for nearly half a century had been a vital source for training Iran's professional elite and a center of political dissent, exhibited a meaningful mix of intents. It displayed the desire of the Qom Hoze to Islamicize, as Khomeini often stressed, the heathen world of the university. Crossbreeding the university with the Hoze became a priority of the regime. The Friday congregation was also meant to overpower with sheer numbers and loudspeakers all other voices, especially the left, which since the victory of the revolution had taken shelter inside university campuses. That Friday prayers continued to be held at Tehran University for more than three decades, despite the availability of larger sites, speaks of the Islamic Republic's existential anxiety. To withdraw from the campus of Tehran University, in effect, signaled a retreat from the revolution's Islamicizing crusade, a concession the regime was, and still is, unwilling to grant at any cost. Other symbolic gestures, benign as they may have appeared at the outset, followed. Iran's cultural revolution, initiated by Khomeini's decree in June 1980, was the start of a widespread purge, Paksazi, literally purification, of suspect elements at all levels, from elementary schools to universities. Probably inspired by the Chinese Cultural Revolution, a torrent of intimidation, terror, massacre, and destruction of mostly academics and intellectuals that consumed Mao Zedong's China between 1966 and 1976, the Iranian version was far tamer, less bloody, and largely concerned with control of educational levers at all levels. It was, nevertheless, deeply damaging to the fabric of Iranian education, professional fields, technological skills, and, most of all, branches of the humanities. The Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution, consisting of Khomeini's appointees from among hardliners, took its cues from the Guardian jurist's directives and furious public speeches. He repeatedly urged the council to rid the universities of all un-Islamic elements and at all costs. By mid-1981, in actions parallel to ousting Bani Sadr and crushing Mujahideen, mobs in Tehran and other provinces randomly attacked university campuses, beating up and injuring students, driving out the left from their offices and paramilitary bases, and in turn occupying campuses. To complete their task, on June 4, 1980, the council ordered the closure of the universities nationwide. They remained closed for the following 3 years, to give ample time to systematically cull undesirable elements. A few days later, Ayatollah Khomeini's directive confirmed the closing of the universities. The need for cultural revolution, which is an Islamic issue and demand of the Muslim nation, has been recognized for some time. The Muslim nation is worried that, God forbid, the opportunity is missed and no positive action has yet been taken, and the culture remains the same as the time of the corrupt regime, when the uncultured officials put these important centres under the disposal of colonialists. Continuation of this disaster, which unfortunately is the objective of groups guided by foreign interests, will strike a heavy blow on the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic, and any indifference towards this vital issue would be an act of great treason to Islam and the Islamic country. Under the rubric of re-evaluation, thousands were expelled or subjected to Islamic ideological tests or sent off to revolutionary courts. The adverse effects of depriving universities of some of their most skilled and qualified faculty, who were labelled anti-revolutionary, idol worshippers, and decadent, soon became apparent at all levels. Intimidated and weary of the ponderous Islamicizing measures, thousands resigned and left Iran or went into businesses or private practice. Professors of humanities and social sciences in particular were targets of academic cleansing, having been accused of facilitating a Western cultural onslaught, tahajjum-e farhangi, or entertaining an un-Islamic lifestyle. Also subject to great scrutiny were faculty with left-leaning affinities, records of currying favour with the old regime, or Baha'is identified as members of the devious sect. Classrooms and curricula also bore the brunt of the Cultural Revolution. Classes were segregated by gender and, though still under the same roof, were under the watchful eyes of zealous security, herasat, agents. Instructors who survived the purges had to meander through ideological minefields when teaching such areas as evolutionary theory, sociology of religion, civil law, and various fields of humanities. History, both modern and pre-modern, was embattled by an indoctrinated reading of the past. Being Islamically correct soon became the order of the day. After the universities reopened in the fall of 1984, committed students, many from among the war veterans or favoured insiders, were admitted mostly on the basis of their zeal and connections rather than their scholarly merits. They weren't shy about challenging their professors and, if necessary, they harassed them in and out of the classroom, or reported them to universities' Islamic associations. A spirit of fear and suspicion quickly set in, diminishing any drive for independent inquiry and academic objectivity. Even the exact sciences were to comply with Islamic ideological values. The students' fervour, however, subsided with time and gave way in many instances to cynicism or sheer utilitarian motives. Acquiring a degree to excel in the regime's technocracy or improve one's chances for immigration prevailed. The regime's grip over the educational system, and especially over higher education, steadily grew and became further institutionalized over the coming decades. Committed cadres, trained under the new system, gradually replaced the older generation of instructors and university professors, though even then the spirit of dissent and skepticism did not entirely evaporate. The maturing of a new generation of academics had its surprises. While seemingly subordinate to the ideological dictates of the regime, many were critical of the narrow-minded superficiality imposed on higher education, and, at times, courageous enough to question the mainstream. Even more drastic was the Islamification of the curricula, the other urgent task of the Cultural Revolution. A fair amount of mandatory Islamic education was injected into the system at all levels, including devotional acts, rudimentary Shi'i jurisprudence, and theology. A systematic effort was also made to substantially revise and rewrite textbooks in the humanities, most notably history, philosophy, and literature. Relying heavily on the Shi'i narrative, new textbooks presented the Islamic Revolution embedded within a salvation narrative, a liberating struggle, as it were, that restored 2.5 millennia of Iranian history gone awry. It aimed to supplant the Pahlavi nationalistic histories of the latter half of the 20th century with an Islamicized version of its own, displaying familiar symptoms, ideologically driven, naive, self-righteous, always pitting good versus evil, and xenophobic. With the emphasis on Islamic history, the Pahlavi promotion of the ancient Iranian past of the Achaemenid and Sasanian periods did not receive the same preferential treatment. With a twist, perhaps borrowed from the Soviet-inspired Tude literature, the power and glory of those eras was attributed to the toiling masses who built empires under the yoke of oppressive King of Kings. The real glories were reserved for the Islamic era, particularly for early Shi'i history. A facile hagiography of the Shi'i imams, mostly based on popular legends filtered through Qom clerical channels, offered a sanctimonious narrative in which persecution and suffering was blended with a largely imagined political activism. This was a picture as unfitting to the Shi'i imams' mostly docile lives as it was disingenuously ideological. The updated language and vocabulary injected into the otherwise arcane narratives, as in the Shi'i books of mourning, Mas'eb va Marasi, appeared surreal, if not absurd. The greatest distortions were rendered in the story of modern Iran as a prelude to the Islamic Revolution. Loyal to the narrative of moral decadence, the history textbooks of the Islamic Republic portrayed Qajar rulers as ignorant, oppressive, and hedonistic, and responsible for Iran's territorial losses to the rapacious European powers. Devoid of any political agency, with few exceptions, Qajar statesmen were depicted as puppets stranded between British and Russian insatiable greed. Predictably, the loss of the precious Caucasian provinces, as well as Herat and Marv, were bemoaned in a tone that betrayed a veiled expansionist complex. Lamenting the fate of the constitutional revolution, the new Islamic narrative accused secular constitutionalists of selling out virtuous Islamic ideals to alien liberal ideologies. It portrayed statesmen of the period as deviant westernizers. By contrast, Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri was celebrated as the true champion of the constitutional revolution, a victim of his Islamic convictions, and a forerunner of an Islamic movement that eventually came to fruition under Ayatollah Khomeini. The only other hero of early Qajar era was Mirza Taghi Khan Amir Kabir. He received an equally idealized treatment, one that was inherited from nationalistic narrative in earlier decades. He was portrayed as an unblemished anti-imperialist champion whose murder at the hands of heinous Qajars robbed Iran of its only chance for reform and progress. The greatest villain of the Islamic Republic's grand narrative, however, was Reza Shah, or Reza Khan, as he was contemptuously referred to in the language of the Islamic Revolution. Portrayed as the puppet of British mischief, the much-favoured conspiratorial theory of his rise to power painted him, and of course Pahlavi reforms, with a vindictive brush. It was as if the entire era had been nothing but a grand betrayal of the spirit of true Islam and the Shi'i clergy, a modernistic aberration with no positive value to the Iranian state and society. Predictably, such a narrative found in Hassan Modarres, by then elevated to Ayatollah status, not a political manoeuvrer, but an innocent martyr of Pahlavi's anti-Islamic tyranny. He was another precursor to the Islamic Revolution. The Reza Shah era, the prevailing narrative of the Ministry of Education of the Islamic Republic assured students, had no benefit. Rather, it had caused Iran's educated middle classes to deviate from the path of Islam. Ironically, the authors of these textbooks and a whole host of the radical Khomeinists were the ungrateful byproducts of this same middle class. By the same token, Mohammad Reza Shah's era received an utterly Manichaean treatment, contrasting the forces of Islamic good under the auspices of Ayatollah Khomeini against the evils of a treasonous Mohammad Reza Shah and the greed, oppression, and subservience he brought to his country. Not surprisingly, Mohammad Mossadegh, often referred to by his Qajar title Mossadegh al-Sultaneh, to stress his aristocratic lineage, emerged in this narrative not as champion of the oil nationalization movement, but as its accidental leader. And, like liberal constitutionalists before him, he too was doomed to fail once he parted ways from the true Islamic leader of his time, Ayatollah Kashani, another turbaned precursor in the sacred genealogy of the Islamic Revolution. A succession of encounters between clerical activism and secular modernity, always corrupt and deviant, offered a modern version of a Shi'i passion play, Ta'aziyyah, with a providential touch, one that was destined to bring Ayatollah Khomeini to the stage as the ultimate saviour of centuries of clerical service and sacrifice. Toward complete supremacy. By late 1983, the regime had succeeded in silencing virtually all voices of political opposition that had helped bring it to power only 4 years earlier. All autonomy-seeking ethnic voices in the country, including Kurdish, Azari, Turkmen, and Sunni Arab natives of Khuzestan, were effectively extinguished. The magnitude of the crackdown becomes even more striking when we take into account Iran's successes during 1982 and 1983 in repelling Iraqi offensives. Compared to the experience of earlier revolutionary regimes in Europe and elsewhere, the Islamic Republic's success was impressive. 4 years into the 1789 French Revolution, and 2 years before the Reign of Terror, the revolutionary process in France was largely unsolidified, and the fate of the revolutionary regime undetermined. By 1921, the Russian Revolution still had a long way to go, having been fighting a widespread civil war that cast doubt on the Bolsheviks' very survival. Even the Chinese Revolution of 1949, with popular support for Mao Zedong, was not fully capable of eliminating its nationalist nemesis. The key to this remarkable sustenance may be attributed to the crucial presence of Khomeini as a revolutionary prophet. He brought to bear, above all, a high degree of group cohesion, to borrow Ibn Khaldun's famous Asabiyya theory of the rise and fall of empires, among his clerical and lay followers with resolve and unmerciful acumen. When necessary, he forfeited even his closest aides or highest-ranking clerical rivals. The clerical network over which he presided had little doubt as to who was an insider and who was not, and in a short time, the eventful course of the revolution made this differentiation even sharper. Saving the self and purging the other quickly became a matter of survival. While the old regime was almost completely wiped out, the participants in the revolution were swiftly sifted through for their doctrinal maktabi loyalty. Group cohesion was complemented by organization and leadership of a strong state. Though revolutionary institutions were chaotic and clerical leadership decentralized and even flawed, there was enough organization and financial resources, thanks to income from soaring oil prices in the early 1980s, to allow the new regime to consolidate. By trial and error, Ayatollah Khomeini and the Khomeinist elite learned the art of survival and its accompanying need for coercion and terror, Their gomified style of politics quickly taught them the intricacies of mass politics, honed their talents for intimidation and control, enriched their radical rhetoric and propaganda skills, indulged their fascination for new technologies, much of which had originated in the land of the great Satan, enhanced their skills in the face of international isolation, and above all convinced them that it was their moment to transform society to their image and ethos. This was a Gome-based style of rule because it was grounded in centuries of madrasa solidarity and decades of isolation from sources of political power, a world steeped in inner rivalries and factionalism, but also unified against the common enemy of Pahlavi secularity. Gome was as much a physical space as it was a mental state, a complex and multifaceted labyrinth with its own moral economy based on the madrasa's frugal life and the clergy's connection with the larger community of believers through mosques, shrines, sermons, and the Muharram mourning ritual. This was the culture now projected onto the larger political stage. In resilience or shrewdness, this clerical community had no rivals, not even the Mujahideen, who nurtured unquestioned organizational loyalties and doctrinal certitude. The latter's leadership, and the leadership of the Fadayan, were as ideologically naive and politically imprudent as the Tudeh was subservient to its Marxist-Leninist idols. Veteran liberal nationalists, either of the Islamist or the secular type, still dwelled in paradigms of the Mossadegh era. They were barely equipped, nor could ever have been, to truly fathom Khomeini and the new brand of radicalized clergy around him. Their uneasy partnership, based on an assumption on their part that divisions of labor were to be observed between the clerical and political wings of the new revolutionary order, proved utterly outdated. Beyond the initial task of facilitating their rise to power, the mullahs had little use for the mild-mannered, democratically inclined men of the past generation. When these veterans chose not to accommodate the hierocracy in power, it was too late. Solidarity and manipulation aside, the new regime benefited tremendously from public support and patriotic sympathies generated by the war against Iraq. The Khomeinists were not shy in acknowledging that the hostage crisis and war with Iraq were indeed blessings for their survival, once Iranians with diverse sympathies chose in the course of the war to put the defense of their country ahead of their preference for the emerging political order. Popular sentiments were still too raw, and resentment for the previous regime too intense, to allow for dispassionate political discretion. In particular, most Iranians saw Khomeini as the only legitimate leader who could steer their country through the treacherous waters to victory over a menacing Iraqi invader and its real or imagined Western backers.